finishing up Zechariah and probably beginning Malachi. So we left off, I believe we finished chapter 13 in Zechariah. Does that sound right? Mm-hmm. We have had some amazing prophecies of Christ, as Christ being the one who is pierced, as Christ being the shepherd who is struck, and as Christ being nonetheless the deliverance of God's people, a third of them. And you can see the symbolic nature of all of this that we've been through in Zechariah, and that symbolic nature continues through chapter 14. But the third, who symbolically represents us, are left alive on account of Christ, and we are put into the fire, not in order to be destroyed, but in order to be refined. And so then that is a wonderful biblical, God-breathed description of what all this suffering means, what these lives are about, what the things that we have to endure in the end will come out to be. A refining, a burning away of the dross and impurities in us, and a refining of the new man, the gold, the immortal soul that God has given us. And that was how we ended chapter 13. Any thoughts left over or questions before we go on to 14, the final chapter of Zechariah? Okay, off we go. Behold, a day is coming for the Lord, when the spoil taken from you will be divided in your midst. Okay, now here what is envisioned is the division of spoil gained by the enemies who attack Jerusalem is described prior to the battle itself. In other words, the headline comes before the event. With this battle, we're going to see it also as symbolic. There's no actual battle in the sense that all the nations gather around Israel and try to attack it. Behold, a day is coming for the Lord when the spoil taken from you will be divided in your midst. For I will gather all the nations against Jerusalem to battle, and the city shall be taken, and the houses plundered, and the women raped. The study note points out that this is not an actual historical attack on Jerusalem, but rather a vivid reminder that the Lord permits his people to experience afflictions. Continuing, Zechariah writes, half of the city shall go out into exile, but the rest of the people shall not be cut off from the city. Then the Lord will go out and fight against those nations as when he fights on a day of battle. Okay, so the Lord takes up the cause of his people and fights on their behalf. Very similar to the imagery of Revelation, where Jesus is depicted on the white horse, remember? And the sword proceeds from his mouth. That's his weapon. On that day, his feet shall stand on the Mount of Olives that lies before Jerusalem on the east. Of course, knowing the full story of Jesus, we remember when he stood on the Mount of Olives, right? He was betrayed on the Mount of Olives. His feet shall stand on the Mount of Olives that lies before Jerusalem on the east, and the Mount of Olives shall be split in two from east to west by a very wide valley. Again, in apocalyptic literature, this is a common way of speaking and not a literal way of speaking. So that one half of the mount shall move northward and the other half southward. And you shall flee to the valley of my mountains, for the valley of the mountains shall reach to Azal. And your study note says that Azal is from the tribe of Benjamin. The reference is likely where his family lived. A place of safety, a place of refuge, where the mountains have surrounded you and the Lord is standing upon them. And you shall flee as you fled from the earthquake in the days of Uzziah, the king of Judah. Okay, that was like the major earthquake that everyone remembers. When the Lord my God will come, and all the holy ones with him. The holy ones here being God's angels, his angelic host. In Matthew 25, Jesus talks about this, that at the judgment, at the return of the Lord, at the establishment, the end of this world and the establishment of the new heavens and the earth, the Lord will return with all his angels, and his angels will be responsible for gathering together the believers and the unbelievers who remain on the earth and gathering them, separating them for the judgment. Verse 6, on that day there shall be no light, cold, or frost. And there shall be a unique day, which is known to the Lord, neither day nor night, but at evening time there shall be light. What on earth does this mean?
Are you waiting for us to answer that question?
Well, yeah.
Global warming.
Global warming. That's right. Radically, yeah. What you're seeing is the making of a new heavens and a new earth, the unraveling of the old heavens and the old earth. Poetically put. Hinted at by this unique day, which is one of these enigmatic statements that, well, it could mean very little, it could just mean superficial, like everything changes, or it could be very deep and profound, like that unique day, that eighth day sort of reality, where God creates the heavens and the earth in 6 days, remember, and back in Genesis, on the seventh day he rests, his Sabbath. Then when the Lord Jesus dies, he dies on the sixth day, rests on the Sabbath, the seventh, and rises on the eighth, or the new day, the unique day. And in his resurrection, he is the first fruits of those who will rise from the dead. He is the first and new Adam, the new creation. He's the dawn of the new heavens and the new earth. All of that could be hinted at here in this phrase, unique day. All the atmospheric conditions that change radically, and we've already seen the geographic conditions change radically with the splitting of the Mount of Olives and the new valley. We're going to see all these themes continue, poetically depicting that heaven and earth are going to be forever changed. In other words, it's going to be new heavens and new earths. A new order, a new cosmos is going to be very different than it was before. If you look at your study note on chapter 14, verse 7, the created light of our present world will be replaced by a light totally different from anything known to humans. Darkness will be eliminated. Isaiah 60:19. And then I add my study note in Revelation 21:23, which I'll give to you. Yes. And the city has no need of sun or moon to shine on it, for the glory of God gives it light, and its lamp is the Lamb. Which you would only need a lamp at night. By its light will the nations walk, and the kings of the earth will bring their glory into it, and its gates will never be shut by day, which you would do if there was warfare or threat, and there will be no night there. They will bring into it the glory and honor of the nations, etc. So, as we sing, the Lamb is the light of the city of God, or the Lamb is the Lamb. So it's the light of Jesus and the glory of God, which is why then Zechariah likewise foresees no light, no cold nor frost. A unique day, neither day nor night, but apparently still evening. But at evening, there shall be light. Now again, I think all of this, rather than trying to map this out and actually imagine a world that looks like this, is simply poetic, describing how all the things we take in this life is necessary. The sun, for example, will be replaced by Christ. And likewise, the discomforting aspects of this life and this world and this existence, cold and frost, will be done away with. And the chaotic elements of this world, embodied in the sea, that no one can control, will be done away with. Not so much that in the new earth there will never be any night at all, but what won't there be? There won't be darkness, there won't be threat, there won't be fear, there won't be discomfort, there won't be need for artificial light, there won't be times where we can't do anything, there won't be a forcing where we have to rest and a time where we have to rest. We're not compelled by any of that. We're all set utterly free and utterly made new in Jesus. That's what all of this is pointing to, I believe. Okay, any thoughts? Otherwise, the vision continues on, changing geography, changing atmospheric conditions, etc.
Question, does this happen on the last day when Christ returns?
Yeah.
So it's immediate then?
Yeah. We don't know how immediate. I mean, in the sense that all of this unfolds, but it's all the same event.
Okay. It's not a near and far prophecy. That there was nothing that happened within the history of Israel that was similar to...
I'm glad you mentioned that, because the similarity would be Jesus' death on the cross, where the sky is artificially darkened. There's no sun. There's just him. And then you have a great earthquake, which we saw an earthquake mentioned with in the days of Uzziah. You have a great earthquake. You have the dead rising. You have atmospheric changes. You have artificial or supernatural, rather, darkness. We have all sorts of cosmological changes happening around the crucifixion of Jesus. So if you're looking for a historic referent to all of this, it would be then. And yet even those events of Jesus' crucifixion point to the final judgment where the dead are raised permanently and the earth is forever shaken and changed.
He did have 2 feet on Mount Olives because that's where the Garden of Gethsemane was, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. Yeah, this is linked closely to the crucifixion of Jesus. And again, theologically speaking, the crucifixion and resurrection of Jesus and the last day that we're waiting for are just two sides of the same coin. They're one thing, they're one reality. I mean, again, the analogy that I was taught, it's maybe not the most friendly analogy, is when we went to war with Japan after they bombed Pearl Harbor, we dropped the bombs. That was effectively the end date of the war, and yet it took them months later to surrender. But that surrendering and that dropping of the bombs were like two sides of the same coin. They were one event in effect. And so likewise, with Christ on the cross, that is the judgment, that is the event, that is the dropping of the bombs, that is the victory won. And on the last day, it's simply the fulfillment and culmination of what was done that Friday.
Pastor, just to go back to chapter 13, the last few verses there, it says it talks about 2/3 of the world will be done away with, 1/3 will be saved, and that's the third that is going to refine us. Mm-hmm. And I just wondered if that gave any indication in general of how many people were going to be saved. And
I think it does in this way. A minority of people will be saved, and yet a great many of them.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's about all we can take from that number 1/3. Mm-hmm. In that context. Jesus will say, wide is the path that leads to destruction, narrow is the path that leads to life.
Mm-hmm.
And that would similarly indicate that it's a minority and it's the narrow way, namely through him, right, by which we are saved. And yet we see in Revelation 7 that of those who are saved, gathered around the throne of God, there's a number so great as to not be numbered. And so a minority, and yet so vast as to not be numbered.
It's like the remnant of time, of what we know of time.
Yeah, and if you sort of think of that symbolic one-third as representing people from thousands and thousands of years ago, and who knows, maybe thousands of years in the future. I hope not, but but you never know. Okay, well, let's continue on with the theme of the last day and the changing of everything. Verse 8, on that day, living waters shall flow out from Jerusalem. Okay, I'd take you back to Revelation 21 that says the same thing. Half of them to the eastern sea and half of them to the western sea, which means the new continental divide is is Jerusalem, apparently, which is important in a couple of ways. In the first way, Jerusalem is the center of the universe, the center of the world anyway, in this depiction. In the second place, the continental divide is the highest point of the continent, right, from which the rivers flow one direction or the other. And so Jerusalem is the highest point, it's the Great Mount, which has been a theme flirted with all throughout the Old Testament and also then somewhat in the New, the Mount of the Lord, and the Mount of the Lord being where Jerusalem is built. And that Mount of the Lord being like the great world mountain, which if you visited Jerusalem or if you've seen pictures of the mountains of Jerusalem and the mountain upon which Jerusalem is, you kind of go, those aren't mountains where I come from. Those aren't even foothills. So it's sort of God's way to choose what is the smallest and the lowliest and something we wouldn't even call mountains to be the greatest mountain in the world, and to then be depicted poetically, and maybe in fact on the last day to be the greatest, the peak, the summit, the world mountain, bigger than Everest, more important than anything. Okay, so the water that flows through the midst of Jerusalem, you know, it's also the water that's so important because it's the living water, and so it's that which gives life and that which sustains life. And it flows from Jerusalem, from the heart to the east and the west, flows throughout the entire world, giving life presumably to all the inhabitants. So it all centers in Jerusalem and flows out from there, giving living water to the entire rest of the world. We see all of that depicted in Revelation 21 again. Verse 9, and the Lord will be king over all the earth. On that day, the Lord will be one and his name one. Simply meaning there will be no other name and no other Lord, no one to share his glory. Everyone will know him and point to him and will be obvious and manifest and wonderful. Okay, verse 10, the whole land shall be turned into a plain from Geba to Rimmon, south of Jerusalem. Okay, so the idea of the mountains being turned into a plain, of course, is echoing Isaiah and foretelling what John the Baptist will do and what the birth of Christ will mean. The mountains are brought low, the valleys are raised up, everything is made straight and plain for the Lord. So all of this then too, Barry, hinting at the coming of the Messiah, also in view of the last day, just sort of combining those two things, as is so often the case in the prophets. Okay, but Jerusalem itself shall remain aloft on its side, from the gate of Benjamin to the place of the former gate to the corner gate, and from the tower of Hananel to the king's wine presses. Okay, which your study note says about some of these places that they're either known or not known, etc., whatever. The point is that Jerusalem itself is sustained and left high. Again, that picture of it being the world's mountain, the great mountain.
When it says Jerusalem, does it actually, it doesn't actually mean the city, but it means something else, doesn't it?
Well, I think it means the new Jerusalem. So combining this with Revelation 21, the new Jerusalem is depicted as coming down from heaven as a bride, you know, prepared for her, the bridegroom, Jesus. So it's the new Jerusalem. Yeah. The old Jerusalem, the Jerusalem below, as Paul calls it, in all likelihood is wiped out along with the rest of this world. And Peter says it'll be by fire. And then as it's wiped out, as it's brought into the death of Christ, it's also raised in the resurrection of Christ. It's made new, and it becomes a new heavens and a new earth for us.
Okay, now the people who would be, have read Zechariah, would they understand what you're telling us?
Well, I mean, they may lack some of the specificity of the Christ event and his death and resurrection, but what they would gather, it, being familiar with the apocalyptic genre, we've seen other prophets write in that genre, is they would gather that the prophet is prophesying that when the Messiah comes and when the end of the world comes, everything will be different. On that day, namely on the last day, we will expect to see great changes geographically, environmentally, politically, in terms of Jesus being alone the king. Everything will change, everything will be set right. They would know and see and understand all of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's really the point of the end of verse 11. And it shall be inhabited, for there shall never again be a decree of utter destruction. Jerusalem shall dwell in security. So that's heaven. That's the new heavens and the new earth. That's paradise forever. Okay, and so that's all the glorious side and the wonderful side. And in this way, Zechariah 14 sort of flips the pattern of Revelation. Where Revelation does bad news, good news, this sort of does good, Zechariah does good news, bad news. And so the good news is this is going to be the result of it. The bad news is what's coming next, and that's this is what's going to precede it and bring it about.
Verse 2, is
that good news? I will gather, oh no, no, not exactly.
Okay.
I mean, yeah, no, that's not good news.
And does it take place the same time as the rest of 14? Or?
I think chronologically it precedes.
Okay.
Yeah. Chronologically, the great battle,
right,
and the siege and the suffering of God's people and then their ultimate victory and vindication all precedes the paradise explained in the next verses. So I guess you're right. Maybe it would be more accurate to say that Zechariah sort of does a bad news, good news, bad news. And in that way, it's very similar to Revelation, which we saw just cycle, you know, several times over, where it's bad news, good news, bad news, good news. And again, not written in a chronological way, but written in a way of, there's two events. There's the tribulation that precedes, and then there's the blessed end. And simply recycling those events over and over, describing different facets of each, preaching each in its own way. Yeah, so we take a chronological step back to the turmoil that precedes the new heavens and the new earth when we look at verse 12 and what follows. And this shall be the plague which the Lord, with which the Lord will strike all the peoples that wage war against Jerusalem. Their flesh will rot while they are still standing on their feet. Their eyes will rot in their sockets. Their tongues will rot in their mouths. Which sounds horrific and is horrific, but that's sort of already happening. I mean, if you think about it, we are all afflicted with death. That's, I mean, we're all expiring. We're all perishable goods. You know, and in a sense, our flesh already is rotting, as is our, you know, as are our eyes, as are our tongues and our mouths. Now, that's not true for God's people. In this way, our bodies will be resurrected and raised from the dead, imperishable. But if all you have is this world and this body, and then you're raised in a body that remains corrupted, then this is very much true, that your flesh rots while you're standing, your eyes rot in its sockets, and tongue rots in their mouths.
The reading of this kind of reminds me of the pictures that we've seen of the people who survived the atomic bomb. You know, how their flesh was rotting and hair off.
Yeah, I think that would be... one very graphic depiction of this very broad curse. That would be one specific. Here in view, though, I think is just all the suffering with which, I mean, how would you summarize this? You would say death. You would say death afflicts them while they're still alive, which is exactly what happens to us. Now, not to us as Christians proper, because our life is hidden and kept safe with Christ Jesus our Lord. This is a temporary affliction. These bodies will be healed and restored and raised new and incorruptible. So these curses, while they apply to us, they really don't apply to us. But if you have rejected Christ, they apply to you in full force. And they are the last word. Verse 13, and on that day a great panic from the Lord shall fall on them. A recurrent theme that God just sends almost irrational fear and panic upon peoples, so that each will seize the hand of another, and the hand of one will be raised against the hand of another, which is really a chaotic, almost insane sort of imagery, isn't it? Where one is so terrified that they're grabbing a hold of whoever they can grab a hold of for out of fear and help me, and with the other hand they're raising it to club someone. And what a vile estate humanity is brought to. Again, not unjustly, because humanity has been arrogant and raised its hand over and against God and his people. Verse 14, even Judah will fight at Jerusalem, which seems to mean join forces with Jerusalem. This is to be the whole remnant, the whole people of God. And the wealth of all the surrounding nations shall be collected, gold, silver, and garments in great abundance. So whereas we began this chapter, verse 14, saying that God will gather the nations against Jerusalem, the city will be taken, the houses plundered, etc. The nations get all the goods, which would be our present experience. On the last day, the opposite happens. The wealth of all the nations is collected and given to Jerusalem, given to God's people. So you see there's a reversal motif here. It's like when Jesus says, blessed are those who mourn, for they shall rejoice. So we are glad to mourn now, because we know it will mean rejoicing. We are glad to be plundered now and refined now, for we know it will mean our purification on that day and our enrichment on that day. Okay, verse 15. And a plague like this plague shall fall on the horses, the mules, the camels, the donkeys, and whatever beasts may be in those camps. Then everyone who survives of all the nations that have come against Jerusalem shall go up year after year to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, to keep the feasts of booths. In other words, there seems to be a Gentile remnant that joins in the people of God. Everyone who survives of all the nations would not just be a physical earthly survival, or else they would still be enemies of God, but rather they survive in the sense of they're not put to eternal death. They survive and live in the Lord, they themselves, out of all the nations. Though they once came up against Jerusalem, now they go up year after year to worship the king who would be depicted as in Jerusalem. That's the whole going up to the mount, to Jerusalem. The Lord of hosts, and to keep the Feast of Booths, okay, which, you know, has multiple meanings. It's the after the harvest feast. But the Feast of Booths, most importantly, pointing to Jesus. The Feast of Booths, or Tabernacles, or Tents, is points to the incarnation of Jesus. Where, for example, in John's, when John says, the Word became flesh, right, and dwelt among us, that word dwelt is tabernacled or intended or embooth'd, to make up words, himself among us. So the Feast of Booths, the tabernacling, the tenting, ultimately points to Jesus being tabernacled, tented in our midst. He is the King, the Lord of hosts, and it is he to whom we go. So that's what this Feast of Booths is likely pointing to, that Isaiah is, that Zechariah is bringing out. In a different way, from a different direction, Paul plays with this same imagery. I think we heard it in our epistle this last week, and we'll hear it again this next week, where he talks about how we are clothed in these tents, and how we long for a more permanent. He says, you know, it's beautiful because he's going against the Gnosticism of then and now, where he says, we long to be outside of these tents, these bodies, these impermanent dwelling places that are about as comfortable as a tent in comparison to a mansion or something. Right? Not that we long to be naked or unclothed. In other words, not that we long to be bodiless. That's not a good way either. But rather, we want that permanent dwelling place, that resurrected body in a resurrected world, a new heavens and a new earth. That is what we long for. So that idea, too, of being tabernacled or boothed, Paul plays with it, albeit in a very different direction and way. Okay, verse 17, and if any of the families of the earth do not go up to Jerusalem to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, there will be no rain on them. All right, again, this is poetic. The new heavens and new earth, no one's going to suddenly say, you know what, I'm not going to worship the Lord. The Lord's going to say, okay, you know what, no rain for you. This is poetic, meaning to negate even the possibility of this. It's not even a possibility. 18, and if the family of Egypt does not go up and present themselves, then on them there should be no rain. And there shall be the plague with which the Lord afflicts the nations that do not go up to keep the Feast of Booths. So in other words, you keep the Feast of Booths, or you're part of the enemies, right? You go up to Jerusalem to worship Jesus, the King, who's tabernacled among us, or you're his enemies. You get no water and you get the afflictions. So again, all of this is poetically depicting what we already know in the church age, and that's simply that we have faith in Jesus, we worship Jesus. To do otherwise is to be outside of the blessings, to receive no living water, and to receive the afflictions along with everyone else who rejects Jesus. That again is all being poetically depicted in these verses. If you take these verses literally, it's quite ridiculous, and not in keeping with what the rest of Scripture teaches about the new heavens and the new earth. Okay, any thoughts? Yes, Barry?
This is where the evangelicals connect 1,000 years with this and say that this is what will happen through 1,000 years, right?
They're going
to Jerusalem, and Christ will be there, and he will be worshipped. So we're taking 1,000 years out, saying they're occurring now, and we're saying this is something we're doing now, but we will do it face to face.
Yeah, it's not so much that we're taking the 1,000 years out, as we're saying that 1,000 years is a symbolic number, like pretty much every number in Revelation is. And that symbolic number of 1,000 years is the reign of Christ, right? And that reign of Christ we see as beginning when he is crowned and crucified. So that 1,000 years, that symbolic figure, represents whatever's left of his reign on earth before it culminates in his reign in heaven. So if you were to apply this to the church age, then again, in that way, whoever does not worship Christ now is under God's wrath and curse and the afflictions. Whoever rejoices and joins in worshiping Christ is saved from these things, albeit in a spiritual way, in a way that we are saved by virtue of our life being hid in him. Whoever lives and believes in me will never die, that sort of thing. And then ultimately culminating in the resurrection of our bodies. So answering...
He's reigning now from heaven.
I'm sorry?
Because he's reigning now from heaven.
Yes, absolutely.
But then when he comes, he'll reign.
Yeah.
From the new heavens
and earth. Yeah. I mean, Jesus says, all authority in heaven and on earth, and on earth, has been given unto me. So he's already reigning. He's already victorious.
Again,
we're not,
it's the crucifixion and the resurrection.
Yeah, we're not waiting for him to show up and be coronated. He already was coronated. We're not waiting for him to establish an earthly kingdom, because when he's crowned with thorns, he says very plainly, my kingdom is not of this world. So we realize that he's reigning already, and we also are reigning with him. But what does it mean to reign? He reigns as the suffering one. We reign with him when we suffer. Why is he suffering? For suffering's sake? No, to pour out love on a world that loves him not. Why are we suffering? Not for suffering's sake, but to pour out the same love, his love, on this world. So we are his ambassadors. So we are also the drink offering poured out, as Paul says. So we join him in his great offering in pouring ourselves out on behalf of the world. And all that's taking place now. And we're not waiting around for Christ to return and don a three-piece suit and establish a powerful kingdom in that's headquartered in Jerusalem, and somehow all the nations, maybe he'll invent some new laser weapon and all the nations will be afraid and have to give their money to him. Again, when you look at the concrete details of how the millennialists spell out what this is going to look like there, Jesus' earthly kingdom during that 1,000-year reign, the more they have to spell out the details and answer it, you see the more ridiculous it is, and then the more contrary to the scriptures it is. I mean, presumably, you have to deal also with the question of death in those 1,000 years, and some go so far as to say, well, the Christians living in Jerusalem at that time won't die for 1,000 years. Well, if that were true, how would there be any unbelievers left on earth if it was that manifestly obvious? Here you are again. Yep, here I am again. Okay. I mean, why would anyone disbelieve that? So again, it betrays the hiddenness of God. It betrays the idea of faith. It betrays far deeper things than I think are immediately apparent.
When here says that when the nations that do not... celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles, could that referring to hell within the universe of God of the new heaven and earth?
Such that if any of the families of the earth are not part of the kingdom of God at that time, then there's no rain on them, then the afflictions come upon them, then they're in hell. I don't think that that's far off at all from what the sentiment of this is. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. You can take it that direction. It's just what ultimately you have to do is say, okay, in the apocalyptic genre, this narrative is trying to depict a story, and in that story are the truths that come out, and the truths being, in that day, any who do not worship the Lord will be afflicted. That's true presently, and that's true on the last day. Yeah, so I agree with you. Okay, let's go a little further and finish Zechariah. Ooh, we're out of time. Okay, Malachi next week. And on that day there shall be inscribed on the bells of the horses, holy to the Lord, which is again poetic. So what's the big deal about bells on horses? I think the idea, the sentiment is this, down to the very last detail. Everything belongs to the Lord. Everything is holy to the Lord. And the pots in the house of the Lord shall be as the bowls before the altar. Now your study note says that the bowls outranked pots in temple ritual, but on that day they will be equal. And every pot in Jerusalem and Judah shall be holy to the Lord of hosts, so that all who sacrifice... Now wait a minute, every pot in Jerusalem and Judah. Meaning what? It's not just the temple per se, but it's all things. Every pot, every vessel, all the way down to the bells on the horses, everything is holy to the Lord. So that all who sacrifice may come and take of them and boil the meat of the sacrifice in them, there shall no longer be a traitor in the house of the Lord of the hosts on that day. Now that last line points us to what? Jesus cleansing the temple as he enters Jerusalem, casting out the... I mean, so you can see symbolically that what Jesus was doing, while there may have been injustice going on in the temple, what Jesus is really doing when he chases out the money traders is he's fulfilling Zechariah, saying, this prophecy is fulfilled, this day is at hand. And there shall no longer be a traitor in the house of the Lord of hosts on that day. So the Lord fashions a whip out of cords and chases out all the traitors. You see what Jesus is saying symbolically is Zechariah is fulfilled, I am here. Okay, now just a step before that, this idea of every pot being holy and every sacrifice coming from those pots also depicts the time at which the temple itself is destroyed, because the whole world has become the temple. Everything from the horses' bells bear God's up bear God's name. Every vessel is holy, all the world's sacrifices is holy, and all the world's sacrifices to him, the whole world has become his temple, the whole world has become holy. Now all of this can only take place when Jesus the Messiah has come and made us all holy and made the world holy, and all our worship is in and through him who has become all in all. All right, so again, all of these things point us to Jesus and what he will bring about through his death and resurrection. Okay, and that's the end of Zechariah. Any closing thoughts or questions on Zechariah? Okay, Malachi, maybe will take us a couple weeks to get through. And then after that, which would put us on July 2nd, I think, we will start the Apocrypha. The Lord be with you.
Mr. Malley would refer to